Welcome, everybody, and especially the MSc alumni, to this special lecture, which has been put on for the MSc alumni, indeed, which is given by this year's BP visiting professor, Professor Sir Partha Dasgupta. It is a particular pleasure to have Partha deliver this lecture, since he is, in fact, an old friend of the economics department, having been a member of the faculty here for quite some time. And he has taught at many universities around the world, including Harvard, Stanford, and Princeton, and is nowadays professor of economics at Cambridge. His distinguished career spans work in several different fields of economics. He has written widely on resource economics, industrial organization, and economic development, and has written major books in all of those fields, which have had tremendous impact. This evening, he's going to talk to us about an area which has attracted a great deal of discussion and controversy in the social sciences generally over the past few years, the idea of social capital, an idea which has attracted considerable interest in areas of the social science outside of economics, and on which economists have said relatively little. So this evening, we're going to hear about what an economist would say about the idea of social capital. Partha,
thanks. What do I do with this? There is a, I just need this object here. So if I put something here, that will be translated, will it?
Just a second.
Yeah.
Okay. Do I need to,
No.
Thanks. Yeah, this will be fine. Thank you. Thank you very much. Can you, this working? Thank you very much. It's not Cambridge, which is prehistoric, it's I. So I have difficulty with instruments here. It's a great pleasure to be here. I spent many years, my formative years were in this institution, and in one sense, of course, if you have once taught at the LSE and a part of the LSE, it's a sort of lifelong servitude, so I do what I'm told. What I want to do in this lecture is to, you're all ex-MSc students, so this will be a MPhil kind of, MSc kind of lecture. I want to study a concept which has been much discussed over the past 20 years through the lens of modern economic theory. And I will allude to empirical work as I go along. The particular structure of argument that I want to construct here is guided by an attempt to dissuade you from taking the concept excessively to heart. Okay, so I should. I'm going to be quite critical of the notion. Certainly, I'm going to be critical of the strategy that has been used to make us think that as a resource allocation mechanism, social capital is of the profoundest importance and productivity. But that's the conclusion I will be arriving at, but I want to give you some arguments about it. But in order to do that, I'll have to go through the way the concept has been looked at by proponents in political science and sociology in particular. Okay, the idea of social capital sits awkwardly in contemporary economic thinking. Even though it has a powerful intuitive appeal, it has proven hard to track as an economic commodity or economic good. And one should be allowed to do that, to think of it as an economic good, because the name has been chosen very consciously, social capital. It's a capital asset, presumably. Among other things, it is fiendishly difficult to measure. This isn't because of a recognized paucity of data, but because we don't quite know what we should be measuring. Comprising different types of relationships and engagements, the components of social capital are many and varied, and in many instances, intangible. Now, there's been a great deal of empirical work on social capital, and I'll be alluding to some of them to show you how difficult the task is, in particular, how difficult it is unless the theory of it is tied down to some recognizable form, so you know what you're actually measuring or what you're regressing against what. A good deal of the empirical work that you will be familiar with from reading The Economist, let's say, which, bless its capitalist heart, is actually quite soft on social capital. The examples will be from modern industrial economies, England, the continent, and USA, and I'll have something to say about that. But a great deal of the appeal of social capital comes from empirical work from poor agrarian nations, sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia. That you may not be that familiar with, and I'll come to that as well. And I'll try and put together these two types of empirical work and see what they amount to. But prior to that, I need to do a bit of theory with you. So let me give you proposed definitions of social capital. There are many. Every writer has given one. I'm going to give you four here. How is that? Is that visible? Is that legible? No. Is something we've done about it? Beg your pardon? Okay, well, I'll read it anyway. Well, the first, I'm going to quote you two definitions to kick off with. If it's possible to do something, it'll be convenient, because that's all I have. I mean, I was asked to bring papers rather than transparencies. Well, that looks better. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. In his wonderful 1993 book, Making Democracy Work, Civic Traditions in Modern Italy, Robert Putnam saw social capital as features of social organization, such as trust, norms, and networks that can improve the efficiency of society by facilitating coordinated actions. That's a 1993 book. By 2000, he saw it as social capital refers to connections among individuals, social networks, and the norms of reciprocity and trustworthiness that arise from them. This is a published in 2000 called Bowling Alone, and that became very famous. The 1993 book is not all that famous, but it's a terrific book. It's well worth reading, and I'll come to it as I go along. Here are two more definitions, and I'll stop there just to give you a feel for how this object, social capital, has been seen. Social capital, the third definition from Francis Fukuyama, 1999, The Great Disruption. Social capital can be defined simply as an instantiated set of informed values or norms shared among members of a group that permits them to cooperate with one another. If members of the group come to expect that others will behave reliably and honestly, then they will come to trust one another. Trust acts like a lubricant that makes any group or organization run more efficiently. Fourth, from a recent paper, Sam Bowles and Herb Gintis, Economic Journal, quote, social capital generally refers to trust, concern for one's associates, a willingness to live by the norms of one's community and to punish those who do not. Now, there are deficiencies with these definitions, and let me tell you at least two, and that should suffice. A common weakness is this: the definitions encourage us to amalgamate incommensurable objects. For example, in the Putnam 1993 definition, he includes in social capital, in turn, beliefs, behavioral rules, and such forms of capital assets as interpersonal networks. So if I join a community, or I create a friendship, or I get married, that's a relationship that's been created, and that's put on par with beliefs about one another, and also behavioral rules, social norms. Now that causes difficulties, and I'll show you the sense in which it causes difficulties, and I'll come up with the leaner definition as a working hypothesis and see how far it gets us and what it's actually leading to. Furthermore, notice, in connection with the objection I've already raised, is that trust and social norms enable resources to be allocated in ways they wouldn't have been if there were no trust among people, nor the force of social norms to influence individual decisions. So if you recall your micro lectures that you had here, you will remember a distinction, and a very important distinction economists came to recognize as being very important, useful, is objects, capital assets, goods and services that are produced, as contrasted with the resource allocation mechanisms, the mechanisms by which resources get allocated. So say, for example, the competitive market mechanism is one resource allocation mechanism. It generates signals and offers incentives, or creates incentives to individuals to behave one way or the other and take actions, so to speak. A command economy would be another example. An optimizing economy would be a third example, and so on and so forth. When you did your growth lectures, or you attended your growth lectures, the Solow model, or the constant savings ratio, that's a resource allocation mechanism. Tells you if the economy has a certain amount of capital assets, then this will be the evolution of it under the institutional structures that are embedded or implicitly assumed in the Solow model, and so forth. So you can see where I'm heading. I'm going to be trying to dissociate resource allocation mechanisms from the resources that are guided by the mechanism in question. And the weakness of the existing definitions was that they were all conflated. So I'm going to start with a very lean definition and then work with it. And the lean definition would be to see social capital only as a system of interpersonal networks. Trust and social norms typically arise once networks are formed. So the agenda is going to be as to how trust is formed, if it is at all. There's no obvious reason why just because you know one another, you can trust one another. I have plenty of friends whom I wouldn't quite trust to show up on time, if nothing else, all right? Put it this way, I do trust them in the sense that I would then say, it'll be 15 minutes late. That's kind of a prediction of their behavior. Now, in doing this, I'm doing something quite extraordinary in this first 10 minutes of my talk, which is I never do this, worry about definitions. And that's sort of the last resort of somebody who hasn't got very much to say. I don't want it to be that. It's simply that if I hadn't given you definitions, at the end of the lecture, you'd have been saying, well, you've been talking about social capital, but what on earth is that object? I will very soon revert to my usual character, which will be to ask a question and then analyze it. I have not done that yet. I've been doing sort of a scholastic study, who said what about, okay? But you have to bear with me. I want to argue that networks are not the same as relationships or the beliefs that are generated among members of a network in consequence of the relationship. A network can form, people can get to know another, it can run sour. It depends on what they do with each other and with the world around them. So just as the productivity of manufactured or natural capital goods depends upon the use to which they are put, the worth of social capital, in my sense now, interpersonal networks, depends upon the kinds of activities in which members of networks of a network are engaged. This is why writings on social capital so frequently have been studies of institutions. However, to identify social capital with institutions is a mistake. Institutions emerge from networks. They are themselves not the networks. It's the formal way of articulating what I was saying before. Any system of networks can in principle give rise to any one of several sets of engagements. Thus, networks harbor what you will have, an expression you're familiar with, multiple equilibria. Or if you've forgotten them now, in the world of business, if you like, multiple possible states of affairs that may prevail. That's sort of literary rendering of the notion of an equilibrium, okay? Each such state of affairs, or each equilibrium, is characterized by a distinct institutional structure involving a distinct set of human relationships. To be sure, institutions are distinguished not only by the rights, obligations, and responsibilities their members enjoy and harbor. The viability of institutions is dependent on the extent to which members trust one another to fill their roles. Since trust, or a lack of it, is based on the beliefs people hold about one another and the world, institutions are associated with the beliefs that sustain them. To put it another way, institutions are formed and held together by the beliefs members hold about one another and the world. Beliefs are the links between social capital, in my sense, and institutions, and more generally, between social capital and culture. This explains why it is frequently so hard to tell apart writings on social capital from those on culture, especially civic culture, and why it is so easy to slip from speculations on the demands of social capital to thoughts on the imperatives of culture. Though related, social capital, trust, culture, and institutions are different objects and should not be conflated. Trust can be created by a number of means, and I'll come back to that later. Interpersonal networks form only one set of such means. Just to give you a hint, you may trust people you've never met and expect never to meet in a way that economic theory makes so clear in the market, for example. You trust people will be doing things. And the question is, how does that trust create it? That's something that I want to touch upon towards the end. Now, Putnam's original motivation, his 1993 book, which I don't know if you have read, but if you haven't, you certainly should. It's a terrific piece of social science work. Was concerned with a natural experiment that had been performed in Italy. 20 provinces or states of Italy in 1970 had a restructuring in terms of their obligations, the fiscal assistance they would receive from the state, from the center, and what their duties, roles are with citizens. What Putnam did was to look at a 20-year, roughly speaking, a 20-year time span, time series, and asked which of the states had performed well in terms of a whole bunch of indicators, income per head, growth, and that sort of stuff, and what they might have been related to. And what you observed was, and that was really quite ingenious, was that civic association seemed to explain a great deal of variation in growth rates, or in economic performance, let us call it, okay, across these states. For civic association, he had a sort of underlying theory in mind. For civic association, he had very interesting indicators like membership of football teams, clubs, choral societies, that sort of stuff. And bowling alone, which he wrote some years later, was about membership of bowling clubs. Now, the implicit theory here was not something that should surprise game theorists. You join a bowling club or a choral society, you meet regularly for something enjoyable. It's a consumption good, if you like. That might be the original motivation. And while you're there and having a cup of coffee or drinking a glass of wine after the event is over, you gossip a bit. You share information. You may be very, very annoyed with the local administrator who hasn't replied to your letter, okay, some state official. And you express that annoyance to your friend who says, oh yes, actually I'm pretty annoyed too. I wrote a letter to another department and I haven't received the letter reply either. So it facilitates coordinated action. Collective action can take place. It can discipline state governments. That was the mechanism that he was seeking to articulate. So it was the fanciful, the metaphor of bowling alleys and choral societies was simply a method by which you act in concert. Now, of course, there is a civic tradition in the United States, and this looks good. It looks very nice. You've got a vibrant citizenship who are engaged in both consumption and investment activity. Yes. Joining a choral society is a consumption activity in our LSE sense of the term, directly utility generating. But a side product is you take action to see to it that the chap in County Hall is behaving himself. He's looking after your interests. All right? So civic engagement looks good. But the trouble is, as you know from other people's writings, other social scientists, that one man's civic engagement is another man's rent-seeking activities. So you should be careful about that. People can get together, but they could be actually seeking rents, not just dispassionate monitoring of administrative officials. But nevertheless, that's just that's a pause. I want to show how difficult the empirical work can be. In a very well-known 1997 paper in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, the economists Knack and Kiefer, and then Laporta and his co-authors, have studied cross-section data. These are international data, by the way. Now, we've moved away from the states in Italy to international data, and discovered positive links between trust and economic growth. Now, here, there is an independent index of trust, the Michigan Survey on Values, goes around asking questions like, you know, if you dropped a wallet by accident, would you expect it to be returned to you? And if so, would the money be still there? That sort of question. And depending on the proportion of people who are sanguine that would return, you have an indicator of trust. Okay, you regress GNP growth, let us say, or some indicator of economic progress against trust and other things, and trust does pretty well. The political scientists Granato and Engelhardt have studied cross-section data and found positive links between personal motivation For example, the desire to advance oneself economically and economic growth. These are the kinds of cross-section studies that have influenced this literature hugely. Now, there is a problem with these studies in terms of interpretation. For example, in the Engelhardt-Granato study, the motivation to advance oneself would be expected to depend upon one's expectations, i.e. beliefs, regarding the chance that hard work pays off. Moreover, parents would be expected to instill personal ambition in their children only if they were sanguine that such ambition would not be thwarted by the social order. Thus, even disposition can be a determinant rather than a determining factor. In other words, trust or these kinds of motivation should be seen as endogenous variables. They're not exogenous. And if you see a link, if you observe a link between economic performance and these endogenous variables, what you'll be saying to yourself, or you should be saying to yourself, is that there is some underlying force at work, or set of forces at work, such that, if you like, in dynamic equilibrium, you're picking up a relationship between these endogenous variables. So one shouldn't be surprised. One would be certainly surprised if the economy performed worse, if people trusted one another more. That would be a really interesting finding. One could establish that. It's not surprising to find these positive correlations, but these variables on the right-hand side of the equation need to be explained. And that's why starting with networks is useful, and then asking oneself what kind of institutions follow and what kind of equilibria result. So in order to do that, I want to ask, now here I'm reverting to my normal mode and not worried about who said what. I want to ask the following question, which I don't know if you was asked of you when you were doing your MSc here, but some of you were here probably when I was teaching here, and I certainly didn't ask these questions, and I apologize. But there has to be progress, and I think I've learned something since the days you were attending lectures here. Suppose there's a group of people who've got together. How they've got together or why they've got together, set that aside for the moment. And they find that there are some mutually beneficial courses of action they can take. What kind of context can you imagine under which these people would be reasonably sanguine that what they said they would do would actually be done? So it could be that I have a technology, you have some capital, you don't have the technology, and I don't have the capital. And I come to you and I say, well, look, can you lend me some money and I'll set this up, and will be output and we'll share it and so forth and so on. Well, if you don't trust me, you're not going to lend me the money. That's as simple as that. It's sort of part one, econ, whatever, at the LSE. But the question is, under what would be the context in which this might work? Now, it seems to me there are five in number, and there's one which I'll be focusing attention on, or two maybe. First is mutual affection. That's In the LSE kind of language, there's the interdependent utilities, husband and wife, if they're still together, that is. Then you care about the other. You'd feel bad letting your spouse down. If you've said you'll do something, it'll have to be quite a real reason why you wouldn't carry it out. Okay? I want to ignore this motivation, not because I don't live it every day, I do, but that's more in the household sphere of things. I'll be thinking of the household as the unit of account rather than the institution to be explained. So that's one. Having said that, I'll just ignore it, having noted it. Two is something which is deeper. We haven't really investigated it theoretically very much, but there is now considerable amount of empirical work of a sophisticated kind which suggests that we have it, and we should be surprised if we didn't have it. There must have been selection pressures operating, creating pro-social disposition, internal checks and balances. You do what you said you would do, not because you love the person, but because you feel bad if you have let the other person down. It's not you. That sort of idea I want to argue. There is that too, but I'm not going to work with that either, for good reason, because I can explain anything with that. We have it to an extent. What I want you to think about is a very LSE tradition. We are not bad people. We do have some pro-social disposition. We all of us do. But let's suppose the price is high enough where it really starts worrying the pro-social bit. Okay, the stakes are very high, so you can't rely on that Okay? We all have a price, I suppose. And so I'm going to be thinking about those kinds of situations. So I ignore two. Five is the one which we usually see in textbooks. External enforcement, the state. You write down a contract, hire lawyers, see that the contract is okay, and you can trust the other party to carry out his or her obligation under the terms of the contract because you have some sense of the person's disposition, and the price is sufficiently high if the person violates, reneges on the agreement. So there's the external enforcer. Okay? And that's effectively what you have in economic theory, or at least you did when you were doing your MSc. You have a budget constraint on the household or the consumer, and you should ask, why is there a budget constraint? Why doesn't he violate it? And you say, oh, no, he can't do that. Why not? Well, if he does, he gets caught and put in prison or something, or bankruptcy, and all that sort of thing. All the bad things that can happen to a person. So, well, who enforces that? The third party. The problem is that's not a very good answer. And the reason it's not a good answer is you need to justify, or people need to be sanguine, that the third party will do what is expected of it. And today's world, in sub-Saharan Africa and so many parts of the world, is precisely the failure of the expected third party enforcer that's caused so much difficulty. So you need, presumably, some kind of a mechanism, institutional structure, or some context in which the third party, the external enforcer, if you like, actually does the enforcing. If there are some costs to the enforcing, then the enforcer may not be relied upon. That, too, is an agent, remember. So the government needs to be studied, if you like. And that brings me to three and four, which I think are the deepest answers available today. The third is called repeated interactions. It doesn't rely on a third party. You have this group of people who have come to an agreement, and they want to satisfy themselves that the agreement is, they can be sanguine that the agreement will be carried out. People will do what they said they will do. Now, let me be very brief about it, because most of you, I'm sure, know this argument, that provided these people are fairly far-sighted, and far-sighted here now includes in it the notion that the people are not randomly migrating. That's very important. It's repeated means that there's a high chance that they will be meeting next year as well. So possibility of long-term relationships is there. By repeated interactions, I mean the possibility that the situation is such that people can expect or could, if they wish to, engage in long-term relationships. Okay? So this includes nomadic tribes. That's all right, because their movements are correlated. The whole group moves from one region to another. So you can have long-term relationship there. What you can't have it is probably in L.A. Come here, gone tomorrow, and that sort of thing, randomly. So you don't lend money to your neighbor because he's there today and tomorrow he may not be there, that sort of thing. So repeated interactions requires something like stability of the system and an expectation that there will be further relationships. Now there, the idea is that social norms, if you like, can form or can be construed to keep the agreement. So the idea would be that there will be strategies. These are now all game theoretic notions, strategies to be seen as a conditional set of actions, and a norm is, a social norm is to be seen as an equilibrium strategy, okay? Such that if all others follow the strategy, it's in your interest to follow the strategy, etc. Usual kind of definition. So that it hangs together, it's credible. And the idea here is that if anybody reneges, that person will be punished. Natural way of thinking about, I mean, breaking a leg is a possibility, and that happens too. But at one set of extreme, it will be shunning. Don't have social dealings with the person. That's the more civilized way of thinking about it. Others would be breaking a leg. In some communities, it's been observed breaking their capital assets. Fishing communities have been known to destroy or damage boats of fishermen who misbehave in accordance with the agreement about where to fish, how much to catch, and so forth and so on. But generally speaking, that's the kind of idea. And now, in order to get these objects to run, you need second order, third order norms as well. That is, if somebody doesn't punish somebody who deserves to be punished, then you punish that person too, including oneself, by the way, and so forth. And if you don't punish, if you see somebody who hasn't punished somebody who hasn't punished somebody who hasn't, who should be punished, then he in turn gets punished. Now that's where the pro-social disposition kicks in, because empirically you don't see norms that convoluted. Third order, fourth order, fifth order, millionth order punishment. So where do you how can you truncate? Well, the way you do it is, if it could be done, if you have a population where people get angry, the emotions become now quite a convenient rudder, motivating force for setting up norms. And one can even argue that these emotions are universal because there were selection advantages in having them. Remember, if these emotions are pretty costly. When you get angry, you're losing quite a bit of sanity, I suppose, at least temporarily. So there's some cost, but it has a benefit. I mean, in that you can truncate the arguments that are required to support agreements through these equilibrium norms. Okay, so that's one, repeated interactions, and I'll use it for the fifth one in a minute. Reputation, you've heard of, I'm not going to go into it. It has a slightly different flavor to maintaining reputation as a strategic device, not because you want to be you're a man of honor, is that you want to not have an unsullied reputation because otherwise people won't deal with you. That's the kind of argument. It's sort of related to three, so I'll just bypass it. Let's stick to three repeated interactions as a way of having a setting where you don't need, remember, what I'm doing is to have an agreement which is kept without an external enforcer. This is through mutual enforcement. No third parties required, or external parties required. Now, some political scientists have, of course, used three to explain five in political democracies, for example. The state behaves. Why? Because if it doesn't, they'll be thrown out. So there is a repeat game situation there. Even if it's not completely repeated, the point is that there are young people in political parties who will keep the old people who don't care whether their reputation is tarnished under control, because otherwise they'll get booted out, they won't become prime minister or have a whack at prime ministership. So that kind of argument has been used, in other words, a combination of three and four to explain five. So as I said, five is not really a deep answer. The deep answer really rests on some variant of three and four. Right, so that's basically the setup. And in repeated interactions, long-term relationships are possible, as I say. You can have an agreement, and then you have sanctions, social norms for implementing the agreement. Do we have empirical evidence of that? And the answer is yes, plenty. Particularly in poor agrarian communities, where it's not very difficult to imagine small villages far away from capital cities, other villages. Take an arbitrary village in Zambia or the Gambia or some semi-arid area where the villages are separated by quite a distance, miles and miles and miles, and there are no roads. The state is not there, probably fortunately for them. But what do? Now you might say, well, there's the village chieftain or the head of the kinship. That's actually buck passing, because that's like five. You need really to get to something like three or four, okay? And we have a huge empirical basis now for observing, for noting that in a number of kinds of transactions. Most frequently studied in development economics has been common property resources, grazing fields, ponds, local forests, all that stuff out there on the basis of which, not quite agricultural fields, although in parts of Sub-Saharan, large chunks of Sub-Saharan Africa, even agricultural land is communally owned, i.e. owned by the kinship, or used to be until very recently anyway. But in my part of the world, where it's sort of river-fed agriculture, private property holds as regards agricultural land for reasons LSE graduates have no difficulty trying to interpret, but from many others, they're common property. Common property doesn't mean Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons. It doesn't mean free access. It's not open access. It's common to the villages where the local resource lies. And people like Eleanor Ostrom, the political scientist, and many others, even before them, Kanchan Chopra of the Institute of Economic Growth in Delhi, did some very pioneering work, really pioneering work, on observing the manner in which these resources were managed if it's a common property resource, you need to have some kind of an agreement as to how. Now, the agreement doesn't happen in the form of a meeting where you sort of sign a contract, nothing of that sort. You don't touch this tree at such and such time of the year because that's when it grows. You don't pluck fruit from such and such part of the pond because that's when it grows, and so forth and so on. And monitoring is easy, remember? In a small village, people can observe each other's action, absolutely essential for running any such agreement. So there's a great deal of work of that sort. Then there are empirical work on insurance. Chris Udry of Yale University has observed that something like 97% of the loans in Nigeria, in a part of Nigeria where he did a sample, are nothing to do with banks. It's to do with borrowing from your neighbor. Neighbor in this case probably has a lot to do with kinship, because moral hazard problems are reduced thereby. Okay? Insurance, public goods, the creation of public goods like drainage system, agricultural drainage, local public goods, okay, something that is communally helpful, protection against floods for the village, so forth. There are obvious free rider problems there, but they've been solved or they've been met. Okay? And of course there's credit, and I started with that. There's been now wonderful empirical work, very careful empirical work done by a group at MIT who have shown how credit, informal credit in village-based life, has played an important role in there. So where are we? Sounds very good. Sounds like social capital is just the stuff. Where am I? Seem to have lost something. No, I haven't. Sorry. I now want to talk about the weakness of this mode of organization, this reliance on networks as a resource allocation mechanism. I think the context matters hugely. It's one thing to think about disciplining local government in a well-functioning democracy. It's another thing to say this is the source of economic progress for a very poor nation. The first weakness that I want to point out to is that social capital, in my sense, networks, network-based exchanges, if you like, is exclusive, not inclusive. When resources are guided by social capital, they don't flow to their most productive uses. For obvious reason. If the resource allocation, the reason you can trust X is because X is related to you. But Y, whom you do not know, may be much more productive for your capital. But you can't afford to give it to Y because you can't trust Y. You don't have a mechanism for trusting. Whereas X you can, because it's related or you're part of the choral society. But X may be far less productive for your capital asset. Okay? So the advantage of the external enforcer for that reed estate, which actually I'm talking about, of course, an external enforcer who does enforce without undue corruption, obviously goes without saying. That's the whole point. We want to see whether that can be brought about. The great advantage of that is that resources, you can lend money to an anonymous borrower. And it is at that route that the more productive channels can be exploited. So that's one. Related to it is something which is less benign. This might be just inefficient, but it's not aggressively non-benign, if you like. But the second one is being exclusive. The idea of us versus them can assume importance. For example, street gangs. Now, there's a lot of social capital there. Two networks, very well embedded, do lots of things together, fool around, hang out, drink and so forth, but periodically are at war, turf wars and so forth, because there is a very distinct us and them here. And that's encouraged by the exclusivity of the relationships. But third, and that's what I want to in some sense come to, because that's a surprise. This so far is not a surprise. A great deal of game theory and pretty much the whole of social capital literature that I'm familiar with has been influenced by repeated plays of the Prisoner's Dilemma game, end-person Prisoner's Dilemma game. So when I said, I began by saying, suppose there's a group of people who have got together and they found some mutually beneficial course of action, under what contexts can they trust one another to carry out their agreement? That was a reasonable question to ask, but there is a sense in which it was presupposing an answer, and I'll make that clear in about 2 minutes. But what I had in mind, and my guess is you had it in mind too, especially when I gave you the example of common property resources, you say, aha, that looks like a nice PD game at work. Imagine that you can, from a common property resource, there are N people in the village, or N households in the village, and the agreement is that you will take only so much, each household will take so much from the common property each year, no more. And there's a free-riding difficult problem here, because like a common pool. And so if you can take two possible strategies or actions, take a lot, take the required amount, each will have an incentive to take a lot because he's only one in N. That's the kind of argument. Now, in the Prisoner's Dilemma game, which is repeated, now remember we were using the repeated game argument, so the metaphor was the agreement is over the repeated Prisoner's Dilemma game. Every year you play this game. Because every year there's a renewal of the natural resource, let's say a fishery, and you're fisher folk. That's one example. It's a common property. And there's an understanding that you don't fish at such and such time of the year from this particular part of the shoreline because that's where they spawn, and so forth and so on. And you don't catch more than so much because the net regeneration rate would otherwise be affected. Not very hard to imagine this happening over the cod fishery and so forth in the open seas. I'm talking now about coastal fisheries, where of course that's very much like a common property in some parts of the world, in Japan for example. Some of the best work, by the way, on the common property resources has been done on fisheries in Japan. Now, the Prisoner's Dilemma game, so you're to imagine there's a PD game being repeated each year, or each month, or each day, it doesn't matter, that's not the important thing. And you monitor each other's actions, not a bad assumption in a small community. There's no privacy in my part of the world, by the way. Shutting a door, by the way, is a act of incivility, I think. They're being snooty, they lock their door or shut their door. And there's a logic behind it. You want to monitor your neighbors. And I'll come back to this issue. Now, the PD game has one very great disadvantage for understanding social capital. And this is the following. This is going to be slightly technical, but you'll have to take it from me, okay? There is, in a normal PD game, the 2x2, confess, not confess, that's the one you're probably familiar with. And that's good enough, because that's the PD game in a generic form, but which can easily expanded to have more actions and more players. Now, it has the unique feature, it has a very strong feature. There's a unique equilibrium played if it's played only once. Just imagine it's just once. And that's what the problem is. It's a dilemma. Each person will wish to confess. But it's a dominant strategy. Irrespective of what the other does, there is the right thing for you to do, which is to not comply. Break the agreement, and vice versa, and the same is true with the other. Now, dominant strategy means that the game's equilibrium is also the minimax values, yields the minimax values of the players. And that's the technical bit, and I will not define minimax here for you. I can at question time, if you like. Well, no, I can't. I have to do this. I'm a professor. I'm supposed to. So the idea here is this. You ask yourself the following question, a stupid question, seemingly stupid question for a normal game. Suppose there is a horrible person out there to do you in. You're playing a game with somebody, and that somebody loathes you. Okay, think of it that way. And imagine now that, think of it situation as you choose first, and then the other person chooses. And you've got a matrix out there. But that person really loathes you. That's the motivation behind that other person. Whatever you do, whatever you choose, he, then... can be guaranteed to choose that action which will be worst for you. Remember, both of us have to choose before the payoffs are realized. Okay? And, of course, to kick you into the worst possible thing might mean that she's or he is losing some utility. But it doesn't matter. She loathes you so much that she's going to do it. So imagine that situation. Okay? Now, think of a game, and there are plenty of games, where the equilibria of this one-shot game, let's say there's a unique equilibrium, just for the sake of argument, it does not yield minimax strategies. It does in the case of the prisoner's dilemma, and that's why it's very limiting, and it looks always as though when people agree, nobody can be worse off by being in a long-term relationship. Because in a prisoner's dilemma game, if it's repeated, remember, in the prisoner's dilemma game, everything is to the northeast, because you have the equilibrium is the worst that can happen to you. It's the minimax, you're reaching your minimax values. And any agreement can be assumed to be, on average, to the northeast. So it could be unfair, of course. One party may take 90% of the benefits of the agreement, the other person only 10%. But who's interested in equality here? We're looking at, is it beneficial? Okay, so, but in a world, in a repeated game in which that particular feature of the prisoner's dilemma doesn't occur, you have a really alarming possibility. You can have exploitative long-term relationship. By which I mean the following. Now, this here I will not give you any illustration because that would take up some 5-10 minutes and we have better things to do with it. But the idea is that think of the single period game. So you draw the diagram with the two people's payoffs on the horizontal and vertical axis. And there is a, let's say, unique momentary equilibrium of that game, one period equilibrium. Okay, like the prisoner's dilemma, except that this one is not a prisoner's dilemma. There are now outcomes possible which are make both parties, let's say, worse off than they would be at the equilibrium. Now, why would they come out? Don't ask at this point. Remember, minimax was defined through a very bizarre motivation on the part of the other party, but it will now make that bizarre motivation do some work for us. Consider a world in which there's a long-term relationship between a man and a woman, and I'm choosing the genders very consciously because the one empirical work I've seen which touches upon it is historical work by my colleague Sheila Ogilvie, to whom I raised this point some years ago, and she works on proto-industrialization in Germany. And she seems to have something like the feature that I'm going to be talking about. But this is an area which really requires serious empirical work. And I'm talking now about the theory of it. I'm not talking about empirical validation. So think of a world in which if there's no long-term relationship, so it's a repeated game, but the parties are not engaged in a long-term relationship. Each period, they're in the unique equilibrium of the game. But now consider a point which is very beneficial, a point of allocation, agreement, a kind of you do this, I do that, in accordance with some rules, and then sanctions are imposed if anybody violates, either party violates. An outcome where, on average, as the game is repeated, the average payoff to the man is much higher, higher than would be in the absence of the long-term relationship, but the woman it's worse. How can it be worse, you would ask? Well, I'm not playing a PD game. I'm looking at a world in which the minimax is worse. Question, can that be supported by social norm? And the answer is yes. That's the beauty of that wonderful repeated game theory, the folk theorem of Aumann and others. How can it be? You might say, well, why should she be willing to enter, to be part? They never enter necessarily. This is part of an ongoing situation. You have codes of conduct, norms of expectations about how people behave, what they do, and so forth and so on. How can it be that such a outcome can be implemented by the society? And the answer is, if she doesn't comply, then she could be minimaxed. That will make her even worse. And remember, that's worse than the long-term not having a long-term relationship. So that threat is always there on her head. She's up against that threat. Why should anybody wish to push such a person into a minimax if she doesn't comply, if she doesn't behave, if she doesn't do what she's expected, even though she's now, on average, worse off than she would be if she weren't part of the long-term relationship? The answer is that if somebody doesn't, then he, in turn, will be minimaxed. So you have this chain of punishments which can sustain an outcome where, on average, one of the parties is in fact worse off than she would have been had there been no long-term relationship. And by the definition of not having a long-term relationship is they're in an equilibrium of the stage game, that is, every period is a single period game. Okay? That can happen. This has not been noticed in the literature, and I believe it hasn't been noticed because, as I say, the metaphor for social capital has been the prisoner's dilemma. That feature cannot happen in the prisoner's dilemma. That's the point. But otherwise it can happen. And as I say, theory has to inform empirical work, otherwise empirical work can't take off. It's going to be very hard to get a line on this. Sheila Ogilvie took a very crude line, but that's the only database she had. This is late 17th century Germany, some provinces there, and in England. And she found, of course, social networks are very dense in Germany, not so dense in England, and what she wanted to do, she being a great historian, had a very sensitive, nuanced notion of what were expected of women in these two regions, what were the obligations and what kind of sanction mechanisms were in place. And then she looked at demographic data regarding women in these two regions and found the kind of result that I was hoping she would, which is that women were doing better in England than they were in Germany. So, let me try and sum up. These are the negatives of social capital as a resource allocation mechanism, network-based exchanges. As a basis for exchange, social capital is really small time. It's exclusive. One reason there's a warm glow towards social capital in writers, sort of left writers and the third world, is very understandable. For the poorest people in rural communities, social capital, if you like, is the only game in town. That's the only institution that's available. There's no state. And if the state comes, it usually comes with guns. So there, it's absolutely mandatory to be hooked up into a dense network of relationships which enable you to survive. Of course it's important. It's totally important. Without it, people will die. From that, however, you shouldn't, jump to that's the saving feature, that's the generator of growth or progress. Because all sorts of horrible things could be sustained under that rubric. You can have, in my part of the country, untouchables who cannot take water from a well. You have to walk 4 or 5 miles to collect water. That's part of social capital. They're embedded in the system. They're part of long-term relationships with others. But people have places and things they can do, things they can expect, and so forth. And in the case of insurance, for example, mutual insurance, to come to less depressing kinds of examples, network-based insurance has the advantage that it may be the only game in town again. There are no banks, there are no serious credit system on offer. Your neighbor and your kinship may be your only alternative. But the weakness of that is your neighbor happens to be correlated with you. So you're not going to be able to diversify your risks much if the insurance is done through that kind of a spatially confined network, and so forth. I've given you other examples. So that's small time. It really has to be replaced by something like a workable state so that you go to type 5, the external enforcement. External enforcement has its own problems, even if you can trust the state, moral hazard and so forth. We know about that, and you certainly know about that. There'll be some trade-offs. So let me summarize by saying trust is essential. Goes without saying. It's not to find regressions. Regressing trust, GNP growth against trust, seems to me to be not a very illuminating exercise unless you found that more trusting societies were doing worse. That would be an interesting result. And we would try and prove theorems then. But as of now, that's pretty. But there has to be a basis for trust, because otherwise you talk about blind trust, trusting somebody blindly. In all this last 55 minutes, I've really been talking about trust which is defendable, which is credible. So the equilibria I was looking at were equilibria. So they were credible equilibria. I can trust you to do what you will say you will do because I know something about you, and you know the cost to you of not doing what you said you'll do is too high. And I know that cost will be enforced, and so forth. Okay? But you don't need social capital to sustain trust. you may need social capital to build trust to kick off with, as historically, obviously, societies did, hunter-gatherers and so forth, because there was only small communities and nothing more, bands of migrants, small communities, small farming communities, and so forth. And they still persist, of course. Great part of India is really a rural area, which now I hope we've all been reminded of by the election results, that it's not just Bangalore. It's just there are 500,000 villages out there. But you don't need social capital to sustain it. You need something else. You need something like an expectation that the external enforcer will do what is expected of it to do and do it reasonably honestly. Now that can be, it may be that you need some social capital to generate it. It may be, that's historical. But you certainly don't need it to sustain it, because the ballot box does a lot. So it is frequently thought that social capital, in my sense, is a substitute for the state. And that's where I feel it isn't accepting in an imperfect way, and that's what I've been trying to argue. Putnam saw it as a complement, as I describe Putnam's work on Italy. But I wanted to argue, and I hope convincingly argued that it isn't that either. Proto-modernization, societies that are in the proto-modernization stage, social capital is of course valuable. That's the only game in town. That's the only thing keeping a person from destitution and survival. But as a basis for transactions, social capital has to be outgrown. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Partha, for a very incisive analysis of a very controversial idea. I think we have some time if people would like to raise questions.
I think that's a terrific point. Yes, I really do agree with you there. And I should have been more nuanced. 15 more minutes and I would have come to science and technology. That's something I'm very deeply interested in. But even there, the networks that work, I mean, I should say as a background to this wonderful question is the fact, a puzzle. We live in a weightless society. Parts of our society, if you like, is weightless, some bits of it, very important bits. And you might think then, at least for certain activities, location shouldn't matter. And yet you have the Silicon Valley, people migrate there near Cambridge and so forth. There are several explanations, but one which I find fairly persuasive is the one underlying the question that was raised, or the point that was made really, is that you need to know people. You know, you're working on a problem and it's nice to be able to confer. Now the interesting, that where I don't go all the way with you, and that's why I was keeping it perhaps for later discussion, was that even there, it's competition versus cooperation that's taking place simultaneously. So let's say you're a mathematician, you're trying to solve a problem, and you've got fellow mathematicians or, I don't know, computer experts or whatever, some problems that are. There are some questions, and this is where social norms really do work, actually. There are some questions you're not allowed to ask, you shouldn't ask. But certain problems you can discuss. You can say, well, I'm trying this out, you know, and it's not working. Do you know any reason why it shouldn't? And depending on the nature of the question, that this competitor might say, well, I wouldn't have tried it. Yeah, I tried it too, it didn't work. There are other things you have to do, or something like that. There seems to be an implicit, Paul David is very good on this. He has interviews with researchers. There's competition. It's not as though the whole thing is a collaborative venture, unless they're, of course, part of a team. That's a different matter. If they're part of a team, then if you want to call what happens in a firm or a factory social capital, fair enough, but you appreciate that's not what I was discussing, because that becomes more like a team, and then you have certain, there are some mutual benefits, and you fire the guy who doesn't comply and so forth. But in a very loose, unorganized way, there seems to be social capital forming, precisely in the sense that you're suggesting, and that is true. But it's happening in a world in which they're at the same time competing, because the patent will go to one, not to all, or the copyright, or whatever, the big time money is going to go. But if they all become completely secretive, then all of them would lose out, because progress would be so much slower. So there seems to be some kind of an endogenously created understanding, and that's where it works. You're quite right. But these are really upmarket kind of solutions to resource allocation problems. And what I was doing, I was using a pretty broad brush to distinguish between types of societies, the poor rural areas versus industrial areas. And there, my focus of attention was really that, and that colored my exposition. But thank you for asking. You're quite right.
Could we have the microphone? Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Professor, you mentioned that that the socially altruistic disposition might have evolved through some kind of biological selection. And then you also suggested that governments will enforce agreements because...
Beg pardon?
Governments will enforce agreements because they like to stay in power, which presumably is because they like power. So to what extent do you think economists should consider sort of evolutionary theory as in accounting for the primitives of the human utility function?
Oh, wow. I'm very, I just feel towards it because you just chase a problem and see how far it goes. The time scale over which we're looking at the formation of basic, when I say utility function here, that's broadly defined. I was thinking of emotions like anger or feeling insulted. Pretty much every society that I'm familiar with or know of, people can be angry. People can feel insulted. Where cultures differ is what you get angry over or what constitutes an insult. That's the multiple equilibria that I was alluding to in some ways. So you go to a culture and you do something thinking it's a very normal behavior, and then everybody frowns at you, don't get invited to dinner again. And you wonder why. Well, you're working on a different equilibrium than the one prevailing. But to the extent my comments really were motivated. There are not very many theorems on this, by the way, I should tell you. So it's a researchable area. That I've often been impressed by the fact that we have these we have these emotions which seem to do some work in a resource, not in a poetic sense, but in the sense of doing some work for resource allocation theory. And the question is, could it be that these have been selected? They survived under selection pressure. That types who didn't have that got wiped out basically because people could free ride on them and they didn't get too angry or didn't get angry enough or something like that. So that's one thing. But the other types of thing, fairness is another. People seem to have a sense of fairness. Where fairness counts, of course, differs. And in America, the notion of fairness is very different from fairness in Africa, as far as I can judge from some of the anthropological works that I've read. In parts of Africa, certainly Hayami and his co-authors have suggested that one of the weaknesses there has been that whenever somebody is successful, it's interpreted as luck as opposed to possible hard work or diligence and so forth. And if it's luck, you need to share it. So the moment somebody makes makes success of something, immediately 18 cousins show up to reload. I mean, I'm exaggerating somewhat, but not much. by the way, because I have discussed it with colleagues in Africa, and they say that is right. And, but they don't see this as a necessary, they see that's part of their obligation, of course. Well, that's the whole point. But the deeper emotions, it seems to me, from what we understand now, they have to be accounted for over the long stretch of time, of course. We are looking at short stretches in economics, but the if you like, some of the parameters underlying our motivation, to the extent that they are universal, that has to be explained in terms of something like a selection pressure. Now, I don't mean the need to eat or something. That's the easy bit. The harder bit are the things which seem to do some work. And what's nice about it is that if it can be shown to do some work, it's really nice because, you see, in the repeated game thing, I mean, because we postulate lack of any emotion, we need these convoluted norms that somebody has to be punished, and if he's not, because these norms are all tactical. So you're punishing somebody not because you're angry or because you think he deserved it or anything. You're doing it because otherwise the whole thing, you know, it's an equilibrium. You're doing it because that's the best thing in terms of your payoffs, and the payoffs don't include anger or you know, that sort of thing. So the answer is yes, I think we need to. Yeah, something like that has to be done. Otherwise, if you want to connect with a hugely successful research program as evolutionary biology has been over the past 25, 30 years, then yes, we need to do that.
I just wonder whether the notion of social capital sort of varies as you move up in your chain of development, so that in more developed countries, the interrelations that are important, the repeated interactions, the reputation effects that count, are those between companies and individuals. So, for example, Tesco's, you believe that their prices are relatively low, you go there fairly often and so on, and they put a great emphasis on reputation.
Sure.
So wouldn't it be that rather than external actions becoming more important, social capital is still there but in a different type of form?
Except one thing. You don't need a network to discipline Tesco. At least your account of why Tesco worries about its reputation is not so much for network, because you could do it through a complaint in the newspaper and bring the damn thing down by complaining. And you know, if you live in a small town like I do in Cambridge, the newspapers are full of letters complaining, you know, this company. Or the other day I was walking by, while walking the dog, such and such thing happened, and isn't terrible, it didn't happen 50 years ago, and so forth. So I wouldn't regard that as social capital. What you're saying, and because I don't think that's really an effect on networks, although it could be, and it, certainly Putnam's 1993 book is closely connected to your sense, because there he saw it as civic engagement was disciplining not the firms but the local government, if you like. But what I was asking was not whether in advanced industrial countries reputation is not an explanatory variable. The answer is yes, it is. In fact, I was arguing that the external enforcer argument does really hangs in the air. That needs explaining. The deep answer is on reputation and repeat interaction, those two, some combination. And that's working, you're quite right, obviously. But I don't think the reputation breaking needs a network. Newspapers are doing it all the time. They're destroying reputations by the minute.
Social networks which facilitate collusion and transmission of information can also allow the members of the social networks to collude and take advantage of those who are outside these types of networks. In fact, this particular reasoning is quite consistent with the evidence which you quoted about females who perhaps were actually outside the social networks in the historical times which you mentioned. How would you how does this reasoning relate to the hypothesis which you presented for why social networks may be detrimental for economic development?
Right, that's a very good question. I have no answer to it because the historical data would be impossible to track down, except that I would question whether it was ever the case that women were outside the network. I mean, they were needed for breeding purposes, if nothing else. What you're asking is, the network was such that sub-networks were formed, that is to say, the agreements, implicit agreements, the norms of conduct, what you can do, what you can't do, what you expect, and so forth and so on, was so instilled in such a way that you could have the males goofing around, or and the women are in cooking independently or something. So one needs to ask how the allocation of tasks, if you like, and behavior norms, you know, whether it can't come out before sundown, or I don't know. I mean, one can think of any bizarre custom, and it's there somewhere in the world. And one wants to ask how that could be sustained, and if it's possible that if it's very difficult, because you have to ask whether the persons whom you're claiming are probably worse off in the long-term relationship than they would have been. You have to do it hypothetical, counterfactual kind of analysis of what it would be like for that person if you were out. Okay, so you're not going to get much mileage out of most data set because it's very, you could easily see countries where it's not possible for a woman, let's take the case that you have in mind implicitly, well, she could take off, let's say. Now, that's going to be absolutely horrible because what's she going to do when she goes into the, there are cases, of course, but that's what we say, there are people you call destitutes who then go into town, they have no connections and so forth and so on, and all sorts of horrible things happen. So that outside option is worse than what is in the long-term relationship, but that explains why they don't move. Question is, are there possibilities inside such that they would have been better off, and in equilibrium where they would have been better off than they are on the long run under it? It's going to be very difficult to prove. As I say, I just have no sense of it, and but it's theoretically possible. That's all I mean. Theoretically, in the sense, that's a perfectly understandable theorem, how it gets chosen, plucked. Of course, remember, one of the things is that we're not very good at, in the social science, and explaining the choice of the agreement point. We are pretty good at explaining why the agreement point is how it's sustained. The choice of it might require some historical, somebody was tougher than another, you know, I don't know, politics. I mean, that's where you start using expressions like politics plays or I don't know what. So I wouldn't know how to even go about it. Sheila Ogilvy did it in the way I described, and that's very crude, probably not believable. I just, you know, I mean, if a good historian looks at it, probably wouldn't tally. Theoretically, it's certainly possible. And we should alert ourselves to these possibilities. If nothing else, it's hard otherwise to know what exploitation means, by the way. My colleagues, when I was a kid, youngsters, there were a lot of Marxists around in those days. And Marx's theory of exploitation, the idea of modeling exploitation, was very much a research tactic. Carl Christian Weizsäcker gave lecture here, I remember, 1971 or 72, in this hall, where he wanted to define exploitation through a linear growth model. But these are completely unconvincing. It bore no relationship. You can have inequality, but that's not exploitation. You might say somebody's usurped. You need to, and here at least I've got a dead good definition. That is, in the absence of long-term relationship, you're on average better off than if you were in the long-term relationship, and yet you are in the long-term relationship. Okay, that seems to me to be a reasonable way of thinking about exploitation. If that's not exploitation, I don't know what is. But thanks, but I just don't know how to answer it properly. Yeah.
You have said that social capitals can be seen as a substitute of the state, and also how can discipline government. But what do you think is the role of social capital in leading to good governance or democratization?
What is the role?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I wish I knew these. I'm not trying to duck. It's just that I don't know. How do you create a workable society? Jesus, if we knew an answer to that, that's sort of the $64 million, billion dollar, actually, these days question. I don't know. How do you, real serious defect of everything what I've been saying is the fact that it presupposes that you're sitting in some kind of an equilibrium with beliefs which are self-sustaining. And you can have then beliefs which are self-sustaining but disastrous, multiple equilibria. How does a society fall into one and doesn't rise to the other? We don't have really a story of that. We can tell stories of the following sort. Banfield's very famous work on southern Italy was one where households were so mistrustful of one another, or clans were so mistrustful for one another, that there was hardly any trade within the region that he... Very famous book, 1958, I think, Banfield's book. So he looked at a completely dysfunctional society. That's an equilibrium, and you might think that that same, with the same parameters, same fundamentals, that economy could be in another equilibrium where actually people, you know, there's some kind of a infrastructure, social infrastructure, through either social networks or a workable state, something, where they were actually trusting each other and exchanges were taking place and so forth and so on, without any change in motivations. How does it move from the one to the other? I have no idea. Nobody has any idea, really. Simply to say that we'll have markets is not an answer. Or saying let's privatize, so that's not an answer. That doesn't seem to have any. And then you wait for things to happen. But things will happen based on expectations, beliefs about one another. And that's where I came in the lecture. We have stories of the following sort. These are all ex post stories. One reason the question is a deep one you've asked, and it's impossible to answer it, is that these systems are usually very nonlinear. Most of the models that I can think of are very nonlinear ones, because basically you're moving the system from one equilibrium to another. And if you want to look at the dynamics of how that can happen, the metaphor could be of the following sort. You're sitting in a deprived area of Los Angeles on a particular day, 20, 25 years ago, when the Watts riots took place. It was all cool, calm. People were hanging around, kids were hanging around, but they're always hanging around anyway, mostly unemployed, maybe a bit of drugs, and so forth and so on. Nothing very much was happening. It was a normal day. Gradually, a few kids got together. Other groups got together. The crowd started building up. And in terms of, there was a disequilibrium phenomenon. Very quickly, riots began. And riots took place, a lot of resources were destroyed, and so forth. Next day, the newspapers described it, but all we had was description. We had no analysis. But then, of course, you couldn't have analysis. They're deprived people, blah, and so forth. What do you expect, and everything. But then why didn't it happen 3 days earlier? Or 4 days later? Well, how does these mutual expectations get together in such a way that the whole system unravels? So maybe everybody did want to steal. Each of them individually wanted to steal, but the cost of it is very high, because if you do it unilaterally, you'll get caught and put in, and then the police will beat you up. So you need there's a coordination problem here. You need to coordinate with others to start going on a rampage, then it becomes very difficult to. Then you'll have a sizable chance that you'll be able to get away with a television set or whatever you want to. But it happens very fast. It moves rather fast. These are like tipping phenomena you've probably read about. But essentially, we have the theory of that. But how that the mechanism triggers is we don't really know. So I don't know the answer to how you get a dysfunctional society to start functioning. But we certainly have seen functioning societies becoming dysfunctional, by the way. But we don't really know what the mechanism is. At least I don't know.
You seem to be ignoring the role of religion in all this, because surely that must have a lot to do with the development of social capital.
Sorry, religion?
Yeah, religion. Beliefs. You're talking about beliefs and trusts, etc. Whereas
yes, but I was thinking of trusts or beliefs about other people's actions.
Will come from a common held beliefs which can be imposed through religion.
Could be. Could be. Indeed, it could be that. Certainly. Indeed. But culture broadly defined, which will include religion, certainly. I mean, if you know you're a Roman Catholic, and if you know you're in Vatican City, you have certain beliefs about what others will do than if you were outside Vatican City in the roads leading to the center of town in Rome. Very different set of characters. So I was thinking in terms of beliefs about others. This is the crucial thing here, is beliefs about what others will do if you did something else. So it's a counterfactuals matter hugely here. What would happen to me if I did this rather than that? I intend to do that, but in order to choose to decide that that is the right thing to do, I need to know what I should, what would happen to me if I do this, because maybe that this is better than that. And then I say, oh no, I'll get beaten up if I do this. Indeed, absolutely, sure, of course, yeah.
For our last question, I'm going to move up to the deprived upper level.
Well, that's very kind. the question, you seem to suggest that equilibria that are based on social capital, in some cases, are, as you put it, necessary for survival, which suggests that moving from those kinds of equilibria to possibly more efficient equilibria will involve significant transition costs. Have you thought about how those might best be managed? Are there any general prescriptions about how you manage the costs in moving from one mechanism to the other?
No. Boy, this is if I knew this was the audience, I wouldn't have accepted your invitation, John. Or put it this way, we taught them well.
That's right.
Right, exactly. no, except what you need to do. But that doesn't mean that we can't think through it. On a case, you might want to think about, let's work through one example, which has to do with the pros and cons of, say, structural adjustment leading to expanding markets in urban areas in third world countries. What could be better? Nobody. Let's now look at a possible negative effect, which I'm not suggesting will override it. But so imagine that you have a village where people are engaged in long-term relationships. Now forget about all the exploitation and so forth. But it's a, you know, some common property management or insurance or mutual credit facilities, that sort of thing is going on. And it involves women as well as men. It involves old people as well as the young. Okay? Now, if the, and that's a repeated game, equilibrium in which, you know, it's a pretty second-rate life, but what the heck, that's the only thing that's available. They're poor people, very poor. Okay. Town expands. Jobs are made available or open up. Very good thing. But now you're likely to have selected migration in such a situation. It'll be the young men who are likely to move. It won't be the women with children, for example, the young children. The cost of migration is very high. Now, so you've essentially created a shift, a parameter shift on the original repeated game, and now you're in a different game. Possibly repeated, but now with a shrunken population, because there is. We have to work backwards, of course, to see whether the men will actually move, but leave that aside for the moment. Then, certain norms of behavior that took place may well unravel now. In particular, if you expect that young men will leave, then you may be less, because you see growing markets, you may be less willing to enter into long-term relationships at a particular time. Because the repeated games require this farsightedness, remember, that it pays to incur costs now because for future benefits, because the benefits will be there in equilibrium, and they may not be. So in that kind of a situation, it's not very difficult to model it and to see the kind of people who might get hurt, who may be worse off in the new equilibrium than they were in the old one, because you have now a different game that's being played with a lesser number of people. Now you work backwards and see that it may be that the young men will move anyway because they're doing so much better. Now you could say that, look, you could have understanding that whoever leaves is going to have to compensate and so forth, but that becomes a sort of really a hugely complicated sort of contracts, which even in formal contract markets you won't get. So that's one possibility, that's one kind of scenario, and there is evidence of that, by the way, from work by social activists, actually. If you read there, one of the things I've discovered is that there is a lot of truth in what you see in the writings of people who are sort of melodramatic and exaggerate. I mean, they don't have the analytical tools, let's say, but they've certainly made observations, which very often are pertinent. And I've learned some of these examples from, actually, NGO-style writing, which are not, you know, they're not my usual fodder, but they're very informative. Now, maybe you need to have some classification of cases and then see whether you need some safety nets, some protection plans, that sort of thing. But I can't see that they are that difficult to imagine through. After all, we in economics and economic policy making, so many more complicated questions seem to be. At least we seem to be comfortable about thinking of people, civil servants, engaged in these decisions. You know, what happens if the fuel tax goes up and then all the general equilibrium effect, there seem to be no end to the number of people who are capable of doing that. So I think if I keep on saying I don't know, it's not so much, I mean, partly it's due to my own limitations, of course, but I think a good deal to do with the fact that this kind of reasoning or this kind of expansion of what constitutes economic transactions hasn't really become ingrained in our teaching or our practical experience. Even in poor countries, we should know better. There, we understand resource allocation through prices pretty well as a discipline. We don't understand resource allocation through these non-market institutions because they hang on something more delicate. But in any case, delicate or not, we don't understand them as well because we haven't worked on them as well or as much. So I think it's in principle possible to do that, do what you're asking. But it has to be done in terms of types of societies, agrarian societies, which may be, let's say, rain-fed agriculture versus semi-arid agriculture, hoe cultivation versus plow cultivation. Inheritance rules. Do women inherit part of the parental assets, the cattle or and so forth? These have very, very important implications on resource allocation and the way things, but we as a profession, we are really bad at not incorporating. I mean, development economists in particular are disgraceful, absolutely disgraceful. 50 years has gone by and they will not take reproductive behavior as an important item to study, even in sub-Saharan Africa, or inheritance rules, for example. Nobody seems to point out, for example, that the very famous state of Kerala, which, as we all know, is the paragon of virtue, is matriarchy in a very prominent set of caste in Kerala. Now, it's very hard to imagine that matrilineal is the word, actually, that's what I mean, matrilineal. It's very, and that's a prominent caste in the Nayars. The rest of the north is very patrilineal, as you probably know. Now, surely that has to have had some significant influence on resource allocation, but if you think if that's pointed out, no, because that sounds sort of odd. Of course, one should ask, why did it go matrilineal? That's going back further into the past and so forth, but one should ask those questions, of course.
Well, that's a wonderfully broad note on which to finish. It's been a pleasure having Partha back in the department this year as BP visiting professor, and a particular pleasure for me to chair the final lecture of his visit. Thank you, Partha. I have been asked to remind our ticketed visitors that there is a reception and you go up to the fifth floor to find it.